Hello, welcome to another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong, speaking to you from Istanbul. In this podcast, I speak to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast. Like the Facebook page or follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. And check out show notes and other links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. If you're a fan of this podcast, you can directly support it by taking advantage of a special offer for Turkey Book Talk listeners, courtesy of Hearst Publishers. In that deal, you can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any one of five great books published by Hearst. Check it out via the address hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. That's hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. Purchasing through that deal is cheaper than Amazon, and it helps support this podcast. Titles included on the list are written by authors who have featured on previous episodes of Turkey Book Talk. They include The Circassian, A Life of Eşref Bey, Late Ottoman Insurgent and Special Agent by Benjamin Fortner, The New Turkey and Its Discontents by Simon Waldman and Emre Çalışkan, The Poison Well, Empire and Its Legacy in the Middle East by Roger Hardy, Out of Nowhere, The Syrian Kurds in Peace and War by Michael Gunter, and Jihad and Death, The Global Appeal of Islamic State by Olivier Roy. To order any of those titles for a third off plus free delivery, visit hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com and help support Turkey Book Talk. Also, if you enjoy or benefit from this podcast, consider supporting it through my Patreon account, which lets you make a small or large pledge on a per episode basis. The standard pledge is $3 per episode, but you can contribute as much or as little as you want. And you can find details and links to that Patreon account through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. But now enough of all that, let's get on with this latest episode, in which we welcome Fikret Adaman, a professor of economics at Istanbul's Boğaziçi University. He's the co-editor, along with Bengi Akbulut and Murat Arsel, of a new volume of essays called Neoliberal Turkey and Its Discontents, Economic Policy and the Environment under Erdogan, published by IB Taurus. The book examines Turkey's current development model under the AKP government, which prioritizes massive energy and infrastructure projects at the expense of dwindling green space and deteriorating quality of life in the country's biggest cities. In this conversation, we discuss the politics of development, various mega-projects like the Third Bosphorus Bridge and the ominous spectre of Kanal Istanbul, and the importance of local municipalities in the doling out of lucrative contracts. The summer just passed has seen a number of freakish weather events in Turkey. In Istanbul, there were flash floods, wild swings in temperature, and almost biblical hailstorms that caused serious damage. I started by asking Fikret Adaman whether he thinks the effects of these weather events had any broader significance, or was it just bad luck?
Well, I mean, that has been on the agenda for a while. My colleagues have been warning us that the impacts of climate change would be felt very seriously in the entire country. And therefore, what we have seen in Istanbul in the last month is nothing but a small portion of the worsening situation in the entire country. So, I mean, for those people who were claiming that the entire issue of climate change is much pumped fear. Now I think and I hope they will be thinking twice. Well, certainly the climate issue in particular and environmental issues in general are very complex, and the current state of science in most cases is not able to very accurately predict the future. And therefore, at the end of the day, you need to rely on the precautionary principle and take appropriate measures. It seems that the entire world, and including Turkey, we have failed to take these measures, and then, unfortunately, we are facing the crude reality today.
And it's not just about weather as well. It's also a kind of very ominous thing that everybody talks about these days is this kind of looming predicted earthquake that people are talking about Istanbul being at risk of. Obviously, Turkey's situated on a whole host of fault lines.
Yes.
Has seen a lot of earthquakes in its recent history. This is a very complicated question about earthquakes. This whole question that the government's been leading urban transformation projects where it refurbishes or rebuilds basically whole neighborhoods using the justification of earthquake preparedness. Just wonder if you could talk about this, like this kind of very ominous prospect of an earthquake shaking particularly Istanbul.
Well, I'm glad you have raised this issue, because normally the earthquake issue is not considered within, environmental issues, whereas on the contrary, it should be. It's part of, natural life, and therefore we need to sort of prepare ourselves to various natural disasters. Well, we haven't included a chapter on this, but I mean, certainly the position of the government is to rebuild at least some parts of the city is something to be discussed seriously. I mean, from a technical point of view, if it's economically not feasible to fortify a building, well, you need to build a new one. But what is being discussed and what we should be sort of investigating is the fact that this issue comes with a political economy side as well. I mean, there are losers and there are those people who gain out of this operation. And therefore, we need to very carefully investigate whether the entire issue has been dealt with in a just manner. This aspect has not been discussed openly, has not been dealt with properly. And therefore, you have lots of protests, you have lots of concerned people, you have lots of malcontent people because of the fact that they feel they were treated unfairly.
And a lot of the book is focused on mega projects, which is, of course, very important when we're talking about this political aspect. And these are basically these huge infrastructure projects funded largely or almost entirely by private companies. And these have reshaped the Turkish landscape in recent years. Recently, of course, there was the third bridge over the Bosphorus. There's the third airport under construction in the middle of a forest to the north of Istanbul.
Exactly.
New airports across the country, actually, energy projects, dams, all kinds of things. Just talk broadly about why these mega projects are so significant in Turkey today.
Well, first of all, they bring about huge social and ecological impacts. I mean, they are mega projects in the sense that their impacts are likely to be mega as well. So that's, you know, one aspect. The other aspect is that there are huge projects in terms of financial side. You need to have huge budgets to build, I mean, airports, bridges, and now the canal project, as you may have heard, is being back on the table. These are really huge projects in terms of the financial burden. The other aspect is that the AKP government has been able to solidify, if you wish, its hegemony over the society, I mean, strongly by these projects. I mean, these are the projects through which the government is able to establish its very existence. That ongoing construction and especially ongoing mega constructions enable the government to say, well, look, we are in the road of modernization, we are in the road of growing, and therefore that hegemony building affects lots of people in the country. And at the end of the day, I mean, most people would say, well, I mean, perhaps, you know, I don't like their policies here or there, but look, I mean, they have managed to build this and that, and, you know, we are proud of this government. So, I mean, basically, we would like to approach this mega project issue from two angles. One is the, you know, hegemony building issue, and then the second one is that they are mega in the sense of their financial burden, their social impacts, their ecological impacts. And if you would like to add a third dimension, there hasn't been any sort of serious public debate whether or not we should have these projects. I mean, they have been implemented on a very sort of top-down manner. I mean, by and large, citizens of Istanbul were not consulted about these projects. And let's remember that when Mr. Erdogan was the mayor of Istanbul in the early 1990s, he was very much against the use of the northern forestry area of Istanbul. And now we have the third bridge and the big airport is being under construction, destroying the northern green belt of the city. Even if you approach the problem from a consistency point of view, you know, we have to raise this question. And in fact, some people did, and unfortunately, we couldn't get a proper answer.
There's also the question that these mega projects are very kind of, they look very prestigious, they're very shiny, and they do kind of have this headline grabbing effect where, you know, it does really set the course of the narrative of this government of modernization and prestige and power. And but also on the, these things also provide great opportunities for the government to kind of dole out business opportunities for cronies and to gain support in that way. Just talk about that aspect as well of these projects, why, you know, how they reinforce the sense that the government has a tap that it turns on and off, you know, however it wants, and is able to kind of secure support for itself in that way.
Well, I think we may ask this question in any sort of country where governments do engage in big projects, subcontracting the projects to third parties, to private companies. So the way in which this subcontracting sort of operation is being made will of course be subject to debates and controversies and so on and so forth. And you can always put a question mark whether there is a kind of crony capitalism in the sense that you don't have a proper competitive process, but rather those firms who have been close to the government are being selected, a kind of a patron-client relationship. And for the case of Turkey, this issue has been on the table for years. I mean, it's not something that came on surface in the AKP government. It has been, this question has been a relevant question, I suppose, throughout the history of the Turkish Republic. I mean, I have myself written a lot on that, that the Turkish system can be characterized as a system in which patron-client networks have always been very strong. From the very early days of the Republic, you know, the government, you know, would go for certain specific firms and people because either they trust them or they have some political connections or for some other reasons. And it's there. I mean, it's part of this society, not only manifested in the relationship between the government and subcontractors, but each and every aspect of life, wherever you go, whatever you do, from the very bottom to the top, from different institutions, you would encounter similar things. So it's a rather characteristic, it's a rather structural problem that needs to be addressed. And perhaps it goes back to the Ottoman days. I mean, it's a big question. But
I mean, while we're talking about mega projects, what's the latest with Kanal Istanbul? You mentioned it before. I mean, for listeners who don't know, this is the so-called crazy project that's been projected for many years, and it envisages the building of a second Bosphorus Strait through the middle of Istanbul, effectively turning much of the city into an island. And there have been all kinds of apocalyptic warnings from biologists and whatnot about the environmental effects of such a project. I mean, what's the latest with that? It seems to kind of drift in and out of the headlines, but...
Well, I mean, WWF has conducted a mini conference a year ago, I suppose, on the Kanal Istanbul project, and most participants have raised their concerns, as you have just mentioned. But at that day, we realized that we knew nothing about the specifics of the project, and we are still in the sort of total darkness. We don't know what type of canal this would be, you know, whether this would have any effect on the ecosystem, and if so, to what extent, and so on and so forth. In order to be able to make a proper assessment, we need to know more. And despite our continued efforts to get some detailed information, for the time being, you know, either this is an idea and they don't have the details, or they have the details, but for whatever reasons, they don't, make them public. So therefore, it worries a lot to us. And I think it should worry a lot to those people living in Istanbul and around Istanbul. And perhaps it should worry, ecologists all over the world. But since we don't know much, we are unable to sort of get into the details. I don't know whether it's going to be a sort of a straight canal connecting the two seas and therefore distracting the entire ecosystem there, or it's going to be a sort of a pooling canal like in the Panama one. We are clueless. Again, I mean, we are talking about such a huge project that would affect, not only the city of Istanbul, but the entire ecological system. And our knowledge level is basically zero.
We've also spoken on previous episodes of this podcast about this question of state guarantees, which are provided for many of these mega projects. And basically, this is where the state promises to pay the difference to the companies that undertake these projects.
Yeah.
If the companies don't make a minimum profit from them. And there have been kind of various reports, including this week, actually, that the third Bosphorus Bridge, for example, is shooting. And it's shooting much lower than this guaranteed minimum.
I think this is also true for the Osman Gazi one.
Yes.
So
it basically means that the state could end up paying like billions of liras for these supposedly free projects. I mean, could you just talk a bit about that aspect as well?
Well, I think, it's nothing but a miscalculation. They have made a rather wrong calculation about the demand for these new bridges. A conspiracy theory could be, just for the sake of exercise, would be that, they made their calculations correctly, and then they knew beforehand that, they would continue to subsidize these private firms for months, if not years. But as we have talked, these projects have multiple roles, and then the government has been benefiting a lot from these projects. So therefore, the gains from the political side might easily overweight the economic loss. So I don't know. I mean, this is nothing but a pure speculation. But on the other hand, if they haven't done this kind of sort of strategic behavior, it means that they have simply made a big mistake. In terms of pricing, in terms of estimating the volume of traffic and so on and so forth. So basically, taxpayers are being shouldering these costs.
And also, the book references the creation of the Ministry of Urban Development and that was only in 2011, which is quite surprising, possibly, for some people. So obviously, it's a very recent thing. And you talk about how it was a very important step because it made it possible to bypass various obstacles to large mm-hmm. urban projects and to kind of bypass negative environmental impact reports. Why was the creation of this ministry so important back in 2011, and what did it change?
After, roughly speaking, 2010, the AKP government felt the need to pump the economy as well as the political life through the construction sector and through the energy sector. In the energy sector, they were eager to build hydroelectric plants, as well as, other energy production units like thermic centrals and, wind turbines and so on and so forth, mainly to deal with the current account deficit problem. I mean, it was very clear from the speeches of Mr. Erdogan and other key political figures of the government that, they wanted to have a big push there. And also, you had this huge urban development, quote-unquote urban development, urban transformation projects. Well, basically meaning destroying some parts of the city and then, building new ones, or simply expanding the cities because of the, continued migration from rural side to urban side, as well as from the population increase. And at that junction, I think the government felt the need to sort of bypass any kind of bureaucratic difficulties, and they wanted to act in a very speedy manner. The main reason as of why they have created this ministry was that sort of practical concern.
And I also want to talk about the kind of social or political effects of all this stuff, because a lot of the pieces in the book examine the link between the AKP's development model and the kind of famous political divides in Turkey at the moment. So there's pieces describing how environmental concerns inevitably clash with this government narrative of like national glory, which is closely connected to these massive infrastructure development projects. And at the really sharp end of that, environmental campaigners are kind of routinely accused of trying to undermine the state and being even the servants of various internal and external enemies of Turkey, and being kind of roped into this conspiracy theory laden narrative that the government pushes. Could you just talk a bit about this kind of political aspect of the opposition to these big projects?
You know, to be fair, this growth fetishism, growing at any cost, this kind of trajectory has been on the table right from the early days of the Republic and has been shared by almost all political parties. But what the AKP did was to realize, if you wish, this growth fetishism in a much sort of effective manner. The AKP government keeps building its hegemony by providing growth figures. I mean, lately, all right, we have achieved 5.2 growth rate, and it's likely that in the next quarter, the growth rate will be a bit higher than that, which will provide a kind of a success story. And by and large, the opposition keeps running its opposition by again discussing on this growth rate, by saying in case the growth rate has not been high enough, well, the government, you know, hasn't been successful because the growth rate was not say 5%, but you know, just 2%. They failed. So there is a kind of understanding that if Turkey grows, say 6-7% per year, it will solve all kinds of economic, political, social, cultural problems. But we know very well that it does not. It has not, and it will not. It hasn't solved, for example, the unemployment issue. It hasn't solved, say, the education problem. It hasn't solved the poverty issue. It hasn't solved the income distribution issue. So I think the real question is that perhaps we need to start thinking over the meaning of high growth rates. And the book basically argues that we should start critically analyze this growth fetishism. And of course, this is not unique to Turkey. I mean, this is more or less, you know, the paradigm that is more or less intact everywhere, which is the sort of the ruling paradigm. So therefore, it's yes, I mean, the EKP era should be criticized on that account. But on the other hand, we should also underline the fact that this growth economy, this paradigm, you know, has been shared by the overwhelming majority in this country, and therefore, you know, each of us should start, you know, thinking on, you know, what growth brings, and you know, what is the cost of that.
What about, though, voters who are kind of happy with the way things are going? You know, there are many people out there who feel they've kind of benefited from this growth fixation. Like, many voters preferred the AKP and Erdogan because they've, you know, the standard line is that they've seen them as being responsible for the kind of rising living standards through the 2000s with kind of the extension of various services, not least like health insurance and health services to a kind of broader population. Yeah. It's easy to kind of overlook these things, but they really kind of did make a difference to ordinary people's lives. And I often think that, you know, these kind of mega projects, the only reason why they gain kind of acceptance is because they're kind of undergirded by these tangible day-to-day benefits that people have seen, you know, these advantages that they've seen over the past 20 years or so. Because if these benefits hadn't been there, you know, these kind of mega projects would just seem like really absurd indulgences.
Well, I mean, certainly there's a point there in the sense that, you know, increased levels of consumption bring about, you know, satisfaction, and, you know, satisfaction translates into political support and so on and so forth. And to add to that, there is this big projects, mega projects that can be sort of seen, you know, as the signs of modern developed country, I mean, back to the glory days. But on the other hand, I think there is a kind of collective action problem here that needs to be carefully thought of, in the sense that, well, okay, it's nice that I get a car, and yes, it's also nice that you have a car, but if, you know, thousands and thousands of people, you know, suddenly get their cars, then you know, the entire traffic would come to a halt, which, well, currently is the situation in Istanbul in the rush hours. I mean, it will take ages to go from one side to the other side, despite the fact that, you know, there have been lots of public transport projects. But still, if you are talking about the kind of impacts that sort of middle class people have enjoyed in the last 10 years or so, I would read these sort of changes as changes that came with a huge ecological footprint and with a huge negative spillovers, negative externalities. I mean, it's good that, you know, instead of living in a small house, it's good that, you know, I live in a sort of four-room house. But, you know, how about the ecological impacts of me having such a big flat? And, you know, by and large, Istanbul and other big cities are becoming really unbearable in terms of the noise pollution, in terms of transport problems, in terms of, you know, all kinds of, you know, issues that are related with ecological footprints. I mean, what's the point of losing the bulk of green areas in a city? So what's the point of having a big impact on the northern forestry area of Istanbul? Well, okay, you have a big airport and okay, you have a third bridge, but what about the sort of ecological aspects of all these? And by and large, we have been myopic in that sense.
Just going back to the points you were making earlier about the kind of social or political effects, because I was struck when I was reading the book, it made me think that a lot of the AKP's development policies kind of dovetail quite neatly with the kind of class aspect of this kind of culture war, for want of a better phrase, in Turkey at the moment. Because the environment is kind of generally seen as this upper middle class or middle class issue, which is portrayed as being like far from the concerns of, quote, ordinary voters. And those lower class voters who tend to be sympathetic to the AKP tend to be also far keener on these prestigious mega projects. I mean, just wonder if you could talk about this kind of political aspect of how development policies are kind of reflected in how people situate themselves within a political narrative.
Well, I mean, your question incorporated its answer. Well, by and large, I think you are right in saying that, I mean, mainly it's the middle upper class people who would be more concerned about, you know, these issues. But of course, there are cases where everyone will get affected. In the case of a heavy rain, for example, not only, you know, the sort of upper middle classes, but, you know, everyone in the city got affected. But on the other hand, I mean, perhaps those people from lower socioeconomic status have not been so sensitive to ecological issues, have not been so sensitive to, you know, the loss of green areas, to the loss of forestry areas, to, say, the sea pollution, and so on and so forth. Certainly, there is a strong sort of opposition. There has been a strong opposition claiming that the AKP government's developments come with heavy ecological costs, well, the majority of the country wouldn't pay much attention to those criticisms. That's true. I mean, otherwise, people would say, hey, come on. I mean, yes, it's good to have a high growth rate, but on the other hand, if this doesn't solve our basic problems, if it doesn't solve our, say, unemployment problem, if it comes with heavy ecological costs, we don't want. No, on the contrary, they say, well, okay, if we have a high growth rate economy, that's great. And if we have mega projects, that's great. So let's go for it. And people, by and large, do not seem to be, you know, heavily concerned with these sort of side effects. And these side effects, as I have mentioned earlier, I would like to underline that these side effects, perhaps some would come much, much, much later on, but most are sort of, they emerge instantly, and some of them, emerge in the very near future. You don't have to wait for centuries. So if you destroy the forestry area in the northern part of the city, this will certainly have a huge impact on the microclimate of Istanbul. That's it. I mean, you don't have to be an expert on that. It's there. It's currently, since they have the backing of the majority, however slim, it seems that the majority that has supported so far the AKP regime is not perhaps sensitive enough or careful enough about these side effects. Perhaps they don't see the link between this kind of developmentalism and its side effects.
And just to conclude, yeah. I want to talk about the kind of role, the increasingly important role, it seems, that local municipalities play in this whole system. Because recently, very famously, of course, we've had this resignation of Kadir Topbaş, who's the Istanbul mayor. Yeah. And there's rumours about the great Melih Gökçek, the Ankara mayor. And of course, these are kind of very key players in the whole system of awarding contracts and rewarding loyal companies and whatnot. And I just wonder if you could comment a bit on this wider role of that local municipalities are playing in this system of construction and graft, basically. Because Topbaş himself, he was said to have been resisting five lucrative construction projects that fellow AKP council members wanted to pass. And that is said to have been one of the reasons why he resigned. So this is all kind of going on under the surface, but it's not reported that often.
Exactly, it's not reported, but either it's true or not. The fact is that it is municipalities that would grant the construction permits, most of them. So therefore, it explains more or less everything. Yes, there is an appetite for construction in big cities, but the power to grant the permit or not is in the hands of the municipalities. And therefore, they have the power, they have the control, they have the sort of, they have the key. And therefore, I mean, if you want to sort of understand the changes in the cities, you need to also look at the way in which municipalities have been acting, not only the government, but local governments as well. Well, I mean, in some cases, yes, we are talking about mayors very much in line with the Ankara government, but in some other cases, we are talking about, you know, mayors from the opposition party. And if you go there and if you make an analysis, an investigation, the kind of picture you would observe may not be, so different than you would see in a city controlled by a mayor from the AKP party. So again, this is a kind of, I would argue, structural problem that Turkey has been living through. The main source of revenue for municipalities, you know, has been these construction permits. And therefore, they need money. They grant construction permits. We have opened up our discussion by referring to the possibility of Istanbul's being hit by a big earthquake. You know, our readers, of course, would remember the 1999 Yalova earthquake, where one of the main reasons as of why there were so many casualties was simply the decisions of municipalities of granting construction permits to such areas that were not suitable for construction. So let's face this reality and go anywhere in the country, you will see more or less the same kind of picture. So therefore, yes, I mean, AKP is not, we cannot sort of isolate the AKP era from these sort of much deeper structural problems. I would like to see the AKP era within this larger context.
That was Fikret Adaman. Many thanks to him. Check out the website armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com, where I've put up links to a couple of related articles, as well as an episode of this podcast from earlier this year, in which I spoke to Esra Gurakar on her very good book on the system of crony capitalism operating under the AKP. Don't forget, Turkey Book Talk listeners can support this podcast and get a 33% discount plus free delivery by purchasing any one of 5 books from Hearst Publishers as part of a special offer. To check out the books available, visit the special page for the deal, hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. Another way to support the podcast is via my Patreon account, making a small or large pledge on a per episode basis. Many thanks to my current Patreon supporters, Celia Jocelyn Kerslake, Michelle Zimmer, Jan Marcus Vommel, Steve Bryant, Aaron Ataman, Max Hoffman, Andrew McDowell, and Paul Levin. Also, please do rate or review Turkey Book Talk on whatever platform you listen on, which really does help increase awareness of it for other potential listeners. Follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay updated with new episodes, and email recommendations, feedback, or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until the next episode in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening.